Thank you very much, Nigel, and it's great to join you all once again. This is now my 7th NFU AGM, and yes, I am still alive, and I hope Q&A doesn't change that later on, but I'm very, very pleased to be with you once again, and I want to thank Nigel for his introduction and pay tribute to Nigel, of course, who's been working like a Trojan over the past couple of years, given some of the big, big issues on our agenda. And I also want to congratulate Alan and Rob on their re-election as Vice Presidents, elected unopposed, my kind of democracy, but of course very much an endorsement of their good work. And as always, we had a very good time last night, and a plethora of Scottish and UK ministers. Is there something happening this year that I should know about? That's what I was asking myself. And I can also say at the outset, I'm sorry, however, that Owen Paterson is not with us, and I know we all want to wish him all his best and a speedy recovery from his eye surgery he had to undertake in the emergency situation just a few days ago. Last year's AGM marked the launch of NFU Scotland's centenary. That was certainly a time for reflection, to stand back and remind ourselves of the significant impact of farming in Scotland. Agriculture has shaped this nation, our culture, our landscapes, our society. It's always been and remains the backbone of a rural economy, and of course is vital to the whole of Scotland. And down the ages, institutions and beliefs have come and gone, and our country has evolved and developed. And often it was the men and women that tended our land that were most affected by these changes. And the formation of the National Farmers Union of Scotland in 1913 gave you a strong collective voice. So as your centenary year draws to a close and a new chapter opens, of course, it's very appropriate to turn to the future. And what better place to do that than here in St Andrews? Near to where we meet today, many famous events have occurred and people have influenced history. And now the St Andrews Cross endures as our nation's emblem and symbolises the crossroads we do face in 2014, when you all have the opportunity to write the next chapter in your story. And there are big, big choices to make. Choices about the future of farming and about the kind of country we all want to live in. On both of these, we can choose two possible futures. Do we struggle to hang on to the old ways, or do we take the opportunity to take advantage of the new? For example, in relation to the CAP, we are now on the brink of the biggest change in a decade. Indeed, for the first time ever, Europe has deliberately set out to redistribute payments. And as foreseen in Brian Patch's inquiry a few years ago, major change is coming. And all of us are facing this together. And let me say, I am absolutely determined to do everything in my power to help Scottish farmers make these changes work, to keep the industry strong to face the future in good health. And each and every sector is confronting the future constructively and with determination. To illustrate this, I need to look no further than last night's spectacular menu, a reminder of just how lucky we are in this country to have so many fine food producers representing quality and excellence, even often in the face of unexpected challenges. Take the pig sector. Our pig farmers have reacted superbly to the closure of Halls of Broxburn last year, which was a blow. The way in which Gordon McKenna and colleagues at Sandy Howie have turned the situation around is a tribute to their firm and visionary leadership and the close collaboration between the sector and the government. And I have to say, I was delighted to see that Sandy was presented with the Ed Rainey Brown Award at the SOS conference earlier this month. And their hard work has delivered real results. Today I'm delighted to announce a £2.7 million grant to create a vastly expanded state-of-the-art processing plant in Brechin. That will almost double capacity to 7,500 pigs per week. So that was a difficult chapter, but we laid the foundation for better times for the pig sector. Another vital sector is, of course, beef, the engine room of Scottish farming. And I will have more to say on that later, but I know that many are anxious. But with record prices and a huge and growing market and highly skilled stockmen, this is a sector that can have a big, big future. And turning to the horticulture sector, after some difficult growing seasons It was great to see output up by 15% in 2013. And in the potato sector, output in 2013 rose to £287 million, a 72% increase on 2012, with exports rising to 49,000 tonnes. And in the cereal sector, last year was something of a relief after the dreadful harvest of 2012, and spring barley production reached its highest in 20 years. And the fantastic growth in the whisky industry means a huge opportunity for growers. And it was great to see the Banffshire branch producing their own whisky with their blended malt celebrating 100 years of NFU Scotland. And despite the involvement of a young apprentice named Lockhead, it is a splendid dram, believe you me. This was also the year our eyes were opened to the opportunities ahead for Scotland's dairy sector. James Withers' groundbreaking report, Ambition 2025, set out the kind of exciting future that is within our grasp. And that future, again, is already taking shape. And I can confirm today that the Dairy Bureau is to be headed up by a full-time manager and will open for business in April. The Bureau will provide dairy farmers with quick access to expert advice and to help them improve their businesses. But the rest of the supply chain has to match the ambition of our dairy producers. And that's why I'm really, really delighted that Paul Grant did agree to bring his vast experience to the role of chairing the Growth Board. And last autumn, our poultry sector was faced with unexpected bad news, with the loss of many jobs flowing from the Two Sisters restructuring. And by mid-November, things looked very bleak indeed. But again, we chose to work for a better future. We're certainly not out of the woods yet, but thanks in part to the good work of the New Growers Association, and I want to pay tribute to Nigel and to Philip Hopley on that, we are beginning to see light at the end of that particular tunnel. The poultry plan we have drawn up together will bring real prospects for that important sector. I have already received responses from retailers and food service companies indicating a willingness to source more Scottish product. And I have to say it would be a travesty if any producer was put out of business against this backdrop. And turning to lamb, this year I was really pleased to see two initiatives designed to secure a better future for that sector. Wham bam, thank you lamb, and also adding value to the Scottish sheep sector, the two initiatives. They again were part funded by the £1 million that we gave QMS after the horse meat scandal to ensure a world-class red meat sector emerges even stronger from that episode. These diverse sectors are all key parts of the huge success story that is Scottish food and drink. Since we last met here, the industry has smashed its records in terms of turnover and exports. It's done so well it's had to revise its targets upwards. And that is what all of you have achieved. So I want to pay tribute to each and every single one of you out there who's contributed towards that massive, famous success. Because you supply quality food for our tables. And consumers are proud of your success and they want to support you. Let me give you some newly published figures to back this up. A survey last month of 1,000 Scots showed that 94% of people believe it's important to have access to local red meat. Almost 55% of people say they would pay more for Scottish branded produce. And over 14% say they'd pay more than 10% extra. That is a huge endorsement of your good work. But of course, we have to make it easier for consumers to identify the Scottish products they want. And that's why we need to make sure we have clear and accurate labelling. And I will ensure that the new food body that's going to be established in Scotland makes this an absolute priority. In the meantime, I'm going to launch a clear labelling initiative. I've asked my officials to work with the Food Standards Agency, the industry, and very, very importantly, consumers, to drive forward improvement. So the fact that consumers actively want Scottish product is very encouraging. However, we need to be vigilant. For example, I am increasingly wary of excessive consolidation in the supply chain. We need to ensure policy discourages monopoly situations and empowers all parts of the supply chain. Because resilience is an issue all along our food supply chain in this country. And that's why it's absolutely vital that we do get the right support mechanisms in place. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is of course why the implementation of the Common Agricultural Policy is absolutely pivotal. The McSharry and Fishler reforms radically changed the focus of the CAP from market intervention to direct support for farmers, and then from couple support to decoupling. And when decoupled was decided in 2003, many parts of Europe did the same in Scotland. They used a historic basis to begin the transition towards area-based payments. But it was always clear that historic-based payments couldn't last forever. And moving away from them is the big change that will begin, of course, in 2015. Europe has made some decisions already, like in transferring funds between pillars. And I know many of you would have liked our decision here in Scotland to result in a smaller transfer or no transfer at all. But I believe my decision to limit the transfer to 9.5% struck the right balance in the circumstances we found ourselves. And I do ask you to remember your sector will receive far more from Pillar 2 than the amount that we've taken from Pillar 1. But with that key decision behind us, we now need to look forward to 2015 and beyond to decide the details of how to implement the new cap in Scotland. The Scottish Government consultations are currently live in both Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, and I will be shortly writing to all farmers in Scotland, reminding them we only have a few weeks left to submit their views to the consultations. Because there are many, many important issues covered by the consultations on which decisions will be needed. For example, I know the arable sector is deeply worried about the impact of greening, and even though we were successful in negotiations and getting major changes to the rules that were originally proposed to make them much more compatible with farming practice in this country, there are, of course, still important decisions to be taken under greening. Again, we're going to pay very close attention to what you tell us. Wherever possible, we're looking for win-win solutions for both the environment and the farming sector. And there are many other issues that I'll focus that are up for discussion as part of the consultation, but I really want to focus on four key areas of particular concern that your President Nigel highlighted to me recently in his letter. The first of those is activity. Here, government and industry are on the same page. Where there's no activity, or just token activity, there must be no payments. And getting the Scottish clause into the cap regulations was a major step forward. But of course, now we may have to make sure the implementation rules are right. And we now have detailed plans to clamp down on activity, and we've shared these with stakeholders just last week. Because the European Commission is crucial to all of this, I've now requested a meeting, a face-to-face meeting, with Commissioner Ciolos in Brussels to make sure we can put our plans directly to him. Believe me, please believe me, I know this is key to the successful implementation of the new cap. And that's why I am launching a full frontal assault on inactivity. We do need a cap that supports dirty wellies and not comfy slippers. Another point Nigel raised was the basic payment regions and their budgets. It's clear that treating Scotland as a single payment region would simply not work. Equally, too many regions, or badly designed regions, could mean an impossible level of complexity. And the size of the budget, of course, for each region is also crucial. This was always going to be a really difficult area, but I do remain genuinely open-minded. We will look very seriously at all sensible suggestions, including, for example, splitting rough grazing into two regions. Our view at the time was that dividing rough grazing into different types in a way that farmers could do themselves would be challenging. But we will look at this again once we've had everyone's views into us. The third issue in the letter was the issue of transition. Some farmers say to me that a quick transition would be the fairest. They say, if my neighbour and I are doing the same thing in 2020, how can you pay us different amounts because of what we were doing in the year 2000? And they say, how can you justify maintaining high payments for people who have reduced activity? Other farmers, of course, take a very different view. They got high payments because they were highly active, and they say they're just as active today as they've always been, but they now face reduced payments over the next 6 years. Of course, I have great sympathy with that view as well. We are on the horns of a dilemma because the cap, which I always thought was about supporting food production, doesn't actually allow us to link support to food production, other than by using the limited couple support schemes we have available. However, again, I do treat all the representations I'm receiving on this issue very, very seriously indeed. I don't underestimate for a moment the potential impact of this issue in farming in general and the beef sector in particular. That's why, for example, I've already signalled that DFO will be at the front of the queue for the limited amount of couple support that we do have in the UCAP. And I have asked DEFRA for the ability to use up to 13% for couple support, in line with what other countries with significant livestock sectors were able to negotiate for themselves. And I am pleased that George Eustace, who was here yesterday, seemed to be open-minded on that, and I will push that door open for as far as it will go. But of course, it is certainly a complicated picture. Many farmers might see their payments go down, but of course others are going to see their payments increase. And of course, those currently frozen out of CAP support will be included for the first time. And we have a smaller budget, and we have other mandatory deductions to make as well as part of the new agreement. But even within the beef sector, there will be those that gain. But this is a bit more than individual winners and losers. It's about the future of Scottish agriculture as a whole. It's about helping farmers to be driven to the market and supported by CAP payments and not the other way around. Every farmer or crofter will respond to the changes in their own way. Talking to farmers around the country, I find that some are planning to expand, but others warn they're going to have to destock. And of course, many are finding other ways to diversify, such as those that I met at Lochleven Larder just last Friday at an agri-tourism conference. That was a room full of optimism. But again, you know, I'm listening to what all farmers are telling me, and I do take their views very, very seriously. I know there's some very, very difficult situations out there, and I want to help if I can. The final issue in Nigel's letter was the role of Pillar 2 in helping farmers cope with change. And here too, again, I'm very open. I'd be delighted to receive your views on how we can use Pillar 2 to help farming businesses evolve and adapt. And in fact, I specifically included the role of Pillar 2 in terms of reference for the Beef Review Group, which I set up and is chaired by Jim McLaren of QMS. I'm under no illusions about the challenges for our beef sector and the seriousness of what is at stake. But I'm confident that together we can achieve a solution which supports those who inevitably face change, but keeps Scotland's pastures in production and, crucially, sustains our production of prime beef that's unequalled anywhere on the planet. So the European agreement we now have to implement is far better than what was originally proposed, but it is far from perfect. So now we must focus on achieving a better future. And we will do that through a combination of cracking down vigorously on inactivity, of using couple support to benefit the beef sector, and devising a package of measures to underpin a beef and sheep industry able to compete with all comers. Measures such as industry benchmarking, so that every producer can measure his or her technical performance and take steps towards higher profitability. However, I know, and you know, we are constrained by the very poor budget settlements. UK ministers negotiated Scotland to rock bottom of the league tables and the pillars of the new CAP. Not one ministerial finger in Whitehall, including the Scotland office, was lifted to secure a fairer budget for Scotland. We actually didn't think it was possible, but we actually emerged even worse off than before the negotiations, thanks to the UK's policy. So the tight budget now means we have to focus on top priorities. Top priorities, for instance, such as new entrants. Because I believe encouraging the next generation is absolutely crucial for the future. New entrants are the industry's lifeblood. Government is doing everything we can to help. For example, the Forestry Commission Scotland's Starter Farm programme continues to grow and generate a lot of interest. We now have 7 limited duration tenancies in place across the country, and we've invested over £1 million upgrading those farms. And I was delighted to meet Richard O'Rourke just last week, along with his wife and his wee baby boy, a real new entrant, who recently took on a farm near Dalbeattie. Richard wasn't handed that farm, he had to compete for it. In fact, the latest farm to be let by us attracted over 50 interested parties. So that's a very positive signal that where we can find fresh ways to address the barriers to new entrants, there's a real appetite out there from young people to get involved in this industry. I'm totally committed to ensuring that wherever there is potential for publicly owned land to be farmed, that every effort will be made to make that land available to new entrants. But I'm also the first to accept that we have to do more to enable tenant farming to fulfil its potential as well. And my Agriculture Holdings Review Group will be working hard over the coming year to bring forward the right solutions for the industry. These might range from industry-led initiatives to new laws. But I will not shy away from taking radical action where necessary. and we need to make it easier for all farmers, of course, not just new entrants. That's why I'm also determined to act upon the 72 recommendation that Brian Pack, sitting in the front row, made in December in his interim report called Doing Better, which targets ways to minimise regulated burdens across the whole of the industry. And I'm looking forward to providing a formal response to his report when he issues the final version at Turra Show in August. And of course, one area where Brian has specifically looked at is environmental regulations. I know they can feel like a lot of red tape, but we have a responsibility to safeguard the land on which we all depend. As we seek to produce food for our growing world population, agriculture has a key role to play in biodiversity, water quality and tackling climate change as well. And we need to have healthy soils and clean water for agriculture to prosper. But there's a win-win here. The health of our natural environment is key to Scotland's hard-won reputation as a producer of high-quality food. Much of the confidence customers have in our produce is because of that reputation. And it's no accident that the latest branding from Scotland Food and Drink emphasises our fantastic landscapes and our pristine countryside. So the environment isn't just a set of rules for farmers to follow, it's a commercial asset on which our brand depends. And again, I'm determined to work with you all to develop a green brand for farming in Scotland and not let other countries get ahead of us. And I could say the same about plant health and animal health and food safety, because high health status is crucial to our commercial success in international markets. But we suffer from a big disadvantage. I hear Alistair Carmichael boasted yesterday about what the UK does for Scotland. He emphasised how many embassies they have around the world. But you know, it's not just about numbers, it's about priorities. For instance, I was appalled to learn recently that despite the Scottish Government's pleas following our recent trade mission to Japan in 2012, the UK only submitted the paperwork in December 2013 to put the case for getting Scotch beef into that highly valuable and vital market. The excuse I received in writing was that the market was not necessarily a priority for the UK government. Sorting out other issues to help us capture new markets is also a low priority for the UK. For instance, we should not tolerate a farcical situation where our industry pays levies to UK GP bodies who are then prevented from promoting specifically Scottish produce or choose to give us a very small piece of the cake. But you know, thankfully, we will soon have the opportunity to take more responsibility for our own affairs. There are just now over 7 months to go until the independence referendum. The nation is now debating the kind of country we want to live in and work in. Of course, I urge your industry to have its voice heard, to have your say. I've spoken many times about the distinctive nature of Scottish agriculture, about how 85% of our land is less favoured area status compared with just over 15% south of the border. I've spoken about the disproportionate importance of our livestock sector in this country and about our need to ensure we support activity in our islands as well as our mainland and our uplands as well as our lowlands. These unique circumstances and the challenges that they pose are best addressed by the people who have the largest stake in the outcome, the people of Scotland. I'm truly honoured to have been Farming Minister since 2007 to make the powers of devolution work for you. But when it comes to many of the really big decisions, the sort of things that could make the real difference between farming businesses surviving and thriving, issues such as taxation, so we can perhaps give incentives to create new tenancies in farmland, or EU representation so we can pursue our own priorities and secure better budgets, or export promotion so we can target our own chosen key markets, or food promotion levies so we can keep farmers' cash here in Scotland to promote our own produce, or the regulation of rural services like Royal Mail, postal services and parcel deliveries and broadband so we can help our rural communities stay connected to the modern world. But all of those things and many, many more. The real power lies with a Westminster government that simply has other priorities. In Scotland, when we agree what needs to be done, we often need UK ministers to act either in Brussels or Whitehall on our behalf. But too often, in my experience, the No campaign is true to its word. No you can't, no we won't, no we're keeping it, and no that's not a priority for the UK government. But you know, now Scotland and all of you in this room and your families and your communities can exercise their democratic right to decide our own future. UK ministers came to St Andrews to sow seeds of uncertainty, no doubt. Well, they would do that, wouldn't they? Take EU membership. Scotland has been a member of the EU for more than 40 years. It's in no one's interest for Scotland to be outside for 1 second. The terms of membership will be negotiated between the 18th of September and the date of independence in 2016. We will still be part of the UK and in the EU for the duration of these negotiations. Our EU membership is secure. If only we could say the same if we remain governed by Westminster. If the UK takes Scotland out of the EU and out of the cap, our industry, all of you and your families and your farming communities and sectors, will be at the mercy of UK ministers who don't believe in supporting agriculture and whose track record in this area is absolutely woeful. And with a yes vote, your cap payments will continue. They'll be secure. Scotland already pays its own way and will be one of the wealthiest countries in the developed world. You know, even the Financial Times said that on its front page this month. And we're, of course, very likely to be a net contributor to the EU. So the budgets are there. And this government, the Scottish Government, will ensure your cap payments are maintained and delivered on time. And in pounds, if you so choose. Scotland is the rest of the UK's second biggest market. When the dust settles after the vote, common sense will support the currency union that people and businesses throughout these islands want to see maintained. After all, even Alistair Barling says that it is logical and desirable. I believe, and my experience in this job tells me, that independence will be truly transformational for Scottish farming. The negotiations for the post-2020 cap will likely begin as early as 2017. Who would you rather have speaking up for Scotland at that top table? A UK government with a track record of letting down Scotland's farmers, or a Scottish government with a track record of standing by Scotland's farmers? During the last cap negotiations, the UK's priorities were to phase out direct payments and remove couple support entirely. And I recall one of the issues that was most often raised by UK ministers at the Council of Ministers during the cap negotiations was the impact of the new regime on a sugar refinery in London. Yet Scotland's priorities were to secure a fairer share of the budgets, to secure more couple support for our livestock sectors, and tackle slipper farming. And I will never, ever forget Owen Paterson in our pre-meet before he went into the Council of Ministers when I was making the case for Scotland, describing our priorities, and I quote, as itty-bitty issues that can be sorted out in the margins. Scotland's key priorities, your key priorities that influence your livelihoods and Scotland's economy, described as itty-bitty issues. And then when Mr. Paterson returned home with an extra €223 million of cap convergence money provided to the UK in recognition of Scotland's low payments, he delivered another slap in the face of our farmers when he decided to keep it. But you know, a yes vote will come at a critical time. That cap convergence money will start arriving in the UK in 2015. But with a yes vote, it would be completely unjustifiable for the UK to retain that money. Without Scotland, they'll no longer meet Europe's criteria for getting that money. But we will. So we'll be in a very strong place to demand its return as part of the negotiations. With the only remaining fig leaf and excuse of keeping the convergence monies, the fact that we pay to the UK as a whole, no longer relevant, the moral argument for returning these vital funds to you, Scotland's farmers, will be absolutely unassailable. So that's one benefit we can immediately get without having to wait for the next cap negotiations. And there'll be a longer term dividend because the EU is on the path to convergence. We lost out the €1 billion we could have had we been a member state this time around, because the funding formula only applied to member states. But with a yes vote, next time we'll automatically qualify for a budget uplift under any new formula. But of course the biggest benefit will be that we can sit down together and decide how to use the powers of an independent country to build a better future for farming and food. I opened this speech talking about the choices we face in 2014. I understand that many of you tell me that these These feel like very uncertain times, particularly as we go through the transition to the new cap. Getting it right is a challenge, the biggest I've ever faced since taking office in 2007. I will strain every sinew to implement the new cap in a fair and effective way in Scotland. So these are challenging times, but they are also very, very exciting times. You have much to look forward to. Your produce is in demand. Scotland's food and drink exports have grown 52% since 2007. And these are historic times. On September the 18th, the people of Scotland will be asked the question, should Scotland be an independent country? I ask you to consider the choice between two futures. One where the future is in your own hands, and one where our future is in the hands of others. Only independence will mean Scotland can move from the bottom of the funding tables to a seat at the top table. Scottish farming has helped shape the country that we live in today. The choice we all make in September will shape our nation's future. Friends, I hope I can join you again next year and look back on a 2014 where Scottish farming built on its very strengths and foundations, its resilience, its innovation, and its determination. And I hope I look back, if I'm lucky enough to be here next year, and I look back at an industry, at a Scotland that has grasped the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to harvest all the opportunities before us, to speak up on our own behalf, to secure the best deals in international negotiations, in Europe, for your families, for your businesses, for your countries, so we can get round the same table together and decide what's best for your industry and then take the right decisions, because we'll have the ability to do that. Just imagine if we could do that, the industry and the government sitting down together to deliver a much brighter future for Scottish farming and Scottish food. Let's harvest that opportunity in 2014. Thank you very much.